Great Lives is a download from Radio 4. We hope you enjoy what you're about to hear. A key belief in today's Great Life is that we have the right to be wrong. Or, as he put it,
truth gains more even by the errors of one who, with due study and preparation, thinks for himself than by the true opinions of those who only hold them because they do not suffer themselves to think.
The words of the Victorian philosopher, economist, and don't forget, advocate of women's rights, John Stuart Mill. I suspect it might also be a key belief of my guest today, the ex-Formula One boss, Max Mosley. Max, J.S. Mill was a great defender and celebrant of individuality. Is that why you've chosen him?
Absolutely, because I think his main contribution, I think, for ordinary people like me, was recognising that if you're not doing any harm to someone else, then you should be allowed to do whatever it is you enjoy doing. And I think that's, for me at least, a fundamental part of a civilised society, that the curtain twitchers don't come and tell you what you can or cannot do in the privacy of your own home.
Max Mosley was born in 1940, the youngest son of Sir Oswald Mosley and Diana Mitford, whose wedding guests had included Joseph Goebbels and Adolf Hitler, which gives an indication of their political sympathies. Max always found a certain amount of trouble, as he put it, attached to him as the son of the once leader of the British Union of Fascists. But he discovered a niche for himself in the world of motor racing, where no one cared about his parents' politics. He has lately again become better known for his private life than for a lifetime's work in motor racing, becoming a thorn in the side of the tabloid press, giving evidence to the Leveson inquiry and fighting for privacy laws after his own privacy was invaded by the News of the World. He's been quoted as saying that to sue the press, you have to be eccentric to the point of being pretty mad, because even if you win, which Max did, you lose money, and the story is broadcast in every detail to many more people than might otherwise have seen it. Are you mad, Max? Why did you sue the News of the World?
Well, I suppose the main reason initially was anger, because I felt that what they'd done was completely outrageous.
What had they done?
Well, they published a story saying that I'd had a Nazi orgy with five, what they described as, hookers. Now, there were two elements of that that were wrong. First of all, the ladies are not, by any stretch, hookers, but also, more importantly, from my point of view, describing the little party we had as Nazi was completely false. And when we got them into the witness box in court, of course, it just fell to pieces. But for me, from my background, with my antecedents, that accusation was outrageous. It was a sort of declaration of war.
The agonising choice for you, I suppose, would have been, firstly, you were not married to these women. It was a party of a partly sexual nature, and it was S&M, so you had to talk about all that.
Well, absolutely. The thing is that, there were several elements. The first one was that my wife had no idea that I occasionally engaged in that sort of thing, so the News of the World came as a surprise to her. But then in court, they were obviously able then to sort of go through all the details. Now, in fact, it didn't do them any good, but it was nevertheless acutely embarrassing. And the problem is with privacy that, under the current law as it is, you sue for breach of privacy, and the first thing that happens is the whole private matter gets rehearsed all over again in court. So it's exactly as if somebody broke your leg in a negligence case, and you go to court, and the court starts off by breaking the other leg. And it never seemed to me to be the right way to do things, but that's how it is.
Your hero, J.S. Mill, also had a very strong sense of justice and injustice, and also was a considerable campaigner himself, something that's not always remembered about him. And to ask more about that, we have on the line from Washington John Stuart Mill's biographer, the former leader of the think tank Demos, former special advisor to Nick Clegg, Richard Reeves. Richard, Mill was unafraid to risk ridicule and disapprobation in the pursuit of truth. You've called him a firebrand. Describe this campaigning side of his nature.
Well, I think it's manifest in lots of different areas of his life. And as you say, Matthew, completely contrary, the sort of received view of Mill as this kind of desiccated, kind of dull thing, Victorian kind of thinker. But actually, I mean, he, particularly when he was an MP between 1865 and 68, he was dragged through the gutter press himself because of some of the causes that he pursued, contraceptive rights from a young man, but probably women's rights in particular was where he had opprobrium heaped on him by the cartoonists and the kind of gutter press of the time. As an MP, when he was supporting women's rights, he was in the cartoons of the time. He was very often portrayed in women's clothing. And there's one cartoon where it says Miss Mill joins the ladies when he was thrown out of Parliament.
He had a searing experience at the age of 17.
Yeah, he was walking to work at the age of 17 and came across a bundle of blankets, and in there found a dead baby that had been strangled and left out overnight. And that wasn't completely uncommon at the time, because families just couldn't cope with the number of children they were having because of the lack of ability to control their fertility. And he was so moved by that he actually went pamphleteering, and he was kind of delivering a pamphlet with contraceptive advice around some working class districts of London. He was arrested, and as far as we can tell, spent a couple of nights in jail before he eventually got out. That is actually something his family was so worried about damaging his reputation, it was mostly kept under wraps. But for me, a philosopher to be, if you like, but at the age of 17 to take those kinds of risks in pursuit of something, it tells me something quite important about his personality.
Did you know Max Mosley about this episode in his life? I didn't.
No, I absolutely didn't, and it just makes me admire him more.
Would you have liked to have met Mill?
Very much so. I'd be fascinated to sit and talk to him, particularly about the sort of dilemmas that arise when you want to reconcile liberty on the one side, freedom on the other, and the desire not to upset or interfere with other people.
Have you found those to be dilemmas? You describe them as dilemmas. Have you found them difficult?
Not personally, because to me I've never been put in a position where I had to make those sort of choices. But these ideas, these opinions, these discussions are important. But in the end, you've got to get on and do something. And that's if you're going to really make a difference. So, yes, try and think out an intellectual basis for what you do. But in the end, you have to get on and a bit of action.
He was known for the clarity of his thinking and his writing. But he also had, as you're saying, Richard, much scrutinised private life, much scrutinised childhood, much scrutinised marriage. We'll start with his childhood. It began in London in 1806, but it didn't last long. John once told a friend,
"I never was a boy, never played at cricket. It is better to let nature have her way."
Not only no cricket, but no holidays either.
"Lest the habit of work should be broken and a taste for idleness acquired."
Poor chap, Richard. It sounds a bit of a kind of bloodless childhood. And his father sort of experimented educationally on him, didn't he?
That's right. I mean, his father and also his secular godfather, Jeremy Bentham, took very strongly the view of Locke and Hartley and others that we were a blank slate when we're born, that we're basically, you should treat us, if you like, as a petri dish when we're born, and then you can just you can mould human minds and put the right information in and essentially kind of create human beings almost from scratch. And they sort of treated John as a kind of experiment, really, and they sort of said, could we turn him into a sort of perfect apostle for utilitarianism and radical politics, and homeschooled him. But it was a kind of extreme homeschooling experiment that was conducted on him, but it lacked any emotion, really. It was kind of without love or pleasure, particularly. It was a very kind of utilitarian in both senses of the term upbringing for him.
What was the nature of the household in which he was a child, Richard? Relationship with parents, brothers, sisters?
He seemed to have quite a warm relationship with his younger siblings, but he had to be their teacher as well. I mean, that became part of his duty as well. But he said later on that he missed that. He described it as that rarity in England, a really warm-hearted mother, which I'm sure is unfair on England and England's mothers. And he lived in fear of his father. His father would deny him food if his younger siblings got their Latin exercises wrong. It was very rigorous. They'd get up very early. He'd work with his father on his books. Then he'd teach his younger siblings and so on. So in a way, I think of the home as sort of, it was very Puritan, but without the Christianity. It was sort of Puritanism stripped of faith, really.
Your childhood, Max, must have been pretty dysfunctional. Your parents were interned for some time during the Second World War.
They were. I mean, I can remember visiting my parents in Holloway, aged about 2.5 or 3. I can remember that quite well. But, of course, at that age, it seems completely normal. You assume everybody does this. You don't see anything unusual about it.
Did you get a lot of grief as a child, as a teenager, because of your father's politics?
A certain amount, but not really. I think a boy came up to me in Germany after I'd been there for about a year with an encyclopedia and said, any relation? And I said yes, and that was fine. And then I didn't get any real aggravation until I got to Oxford. And there I'd resolved to do science, because I thought there you don't have these tiresome debates. It's either true or false. And then somebody said to me towards the end of my second year, of course, if you went anywhere near the Union, you'd just get destroyed because of your father's politics. Well, of course, the next day I was down at the Union. You just had to. And then I got elected secretary and things like that. So I can't really say anybody obviously discriminated against me or behaved badly.
How about in your own mind, if you were not oppressed or hurt by others, did you feel oppressed by any sort of burden of your father's fascism?
Not until I was sort of in my early 20s, and then when I went to the bar, aged about 24, and then I realised that this was actually a major factor. And, of course, the difficulty is, if you have something like that and you have a reverse, you never quite know whether it's because of the reverse or because of you. Mm. And it's like, for example, if you're black, I mean, you would never quite know if you were turned down, whether it was race or whether it was actually because you weren't very clever. And so I always had that behind me.
J.S. Mill was brought up with the immense weight of his father's ambition on his shoulders. What did your parents expect of you?
My father undoubtedly would have liked me to go into politics, and in particular into his politics. And in my sort of teens and very early 20s, I sort of supported him. And I used to go and do debates at universities, which was quite entertaining. But then came the moment about 23, 24, where I realised this wasn't for me. And what I didn't like about it was I used to sit and listen to these conversations in my father's house. It's a bit disloyal this. And they'd all be sitting around the table discussing what they ought to do if they were running the country. Mm. And I thought that's very undergraduate in a way, because the interesting question is not what you do if you were running the country, but how you get to be running the country. That's the difficult bit, and that's the bit you should be thinking about. I began to think it was all a bit of a waste of time.
Mill lost his faith in a different kind of way when he was 20, or so you say, Richard. Not a straightforward crisis of religious belief, but a revelation that made him doubt the world he'd been taught to believe in.
Suppose that all your objects in life were realised, that all the changes in institutions and opinions which you are looking forward to could be effected at this very instant. Would this be a great joy and happiness to you? And an irrepressible self-consciousness answered, no.
What was he saying there, Richard?
Well, it was in a way a kind of religious loss of hope, not Christianity, but of the sort of belief in a particular framework for society, a utilitarian view of politics and so on. And his father and Bentham were political reformers, and you know, they were radicals.
His father was a great disciple of Bentham, wasn't he?
Absolutely huge, yeah. I mean, the greatest disciple of Bentham, certainly at the time. And so they had a scheme, you know, we should do this, the law, free trade, reform of the House of Lords. I mean, there's a sort of a very long kind of manifesto for how to sort of put things right. And what happens there with Mill, I think, is he's fired up with that for some time. But then he kind of realises, in a sense, that even if all those external achievements were to happen, if he were to somehow succeed beyond his father's wildest expectations, he himself would not be happy. He wouldn't feel, as John Stuart Mill, that his own life was kind of valuable. And so what I think was a kind of recognition there that just external success wasn't going to kind of bring him internal happiness. And given that the whole point of utilitarianism was to bring about happiness, the edifice did collapse. I mean, it's worth saying that this happened to him at the age of 20, I think one of the disadvantages or perhaps advantages of his childhood is he had a very early midlife crisis.
Yeah.
I mean, it was effectively a midlife crisis at the age of 20, but it was also it was internal. He kept going to work. He didn't have any friends who he was close enough to talk to about it. And so for a very long time, even the sort of loss of faith that he felt at that time was kept very private, and he didn't want to break publicly with his father. That was a very difficult thing for him to do. So it was quite a private agony for Mill.
This is BBC Radio 4. I'm Matthew Paris, and you're listening to Great Lives, where my guest, Max Mosley, has chosen the life of John Stuart Mill, and our expert witness is Richard Reeves. In 1830, Mill met Mrs. Harriet Taylor at a dinner party at the Unitarian minister William Fox's house. The relationship between him and the married Taylor was controversial at the time and still fascinating today. It was the subject of a drama broadcast on Radio 4 in 1996 by Michael Butt. This is the moment when John and Harriet begin to discuss his book, The Rights of Women.
Tell me, do you think that marriage makes people happy?
Let me think. My line would be this. Most persons, I would say, have but a very moderate capacity
but
for...
But do you observe happiness within marriage? I mean, I see very few marriages where there is any real sympathy or enjoyment or companionship or...
I see. Right. Let us explore the case for divorce. Just a moment. Good. I think I have it. Now, our argument would proceed thus. The statistical chances of finding happiness within marriage are slim. Indeed, marriage is what it has frequently been dubbed, a lottery.
But now, what do you think? What do you feel?
What do I...
Personally.
You mean my position?
No. I mean, what do you feel?
Now, that is interesting.
What?
I don't have any feelings.
Richard, you're a serious historian, and that you may think is fanciful, is it? Is it an accurate portrayal of the effect that Harriet Taylor had on Mill, releasing his emotional intelligence?
Actually, it felt quite true to me. What Harriet did was give Mill a kind of somebody to whom he could take his newfound capacity for feeling and love and emotion. I think he awakened the emotional side of his life through poetry and reading. I mean, actually, he was reading a French memoir, and it was at the point where the writer's father dies that Mill found himself weeping. It was the first time he can remember weeping, and perhaps not a coincidence. It was around the father's death, so there's some psychology there. But then he found poetry, much to the kind of annoyance of his father and Bentham and his friends. He really actually fell in love with Wordsworth. I mean, Bentham famously described poetry as lines which failed to cross the page. So there was kind of no scope for that, really, in Mill's early life. But he was emotionally awakened earlier, but then Harriet came along and it just fell headlong for her, and so she became the object of his new ability to love, and he loved her deeply. It was just extraordinarily inconvenient that she was married with kids.
What did people say? Were they having an affair?
Well, they were having an affair. I mean, whether they were having sex or not, we don't know. But to all intents and purposes, they were spending time together. They had an extraordinary arrangement with her husband. Because she had no legal rights over her children, she didn't want to leave her husband. But they had an extraordinary arrangement where one night a week, her husband would go out to his club and she and Mill would have dinner at their house. And this was quite, you know, scandalous at the time. And when they did go out together, which they almost never did, they described a titter going around the room once when they kind of came in. And all the gossips, Carlyle and Harriet Martineau and people like that, were endlessly gossiping about what was going on. And they would spend weekends together down at her country house. And so they were deeply in love with each other, and they were having, quotes, an affair at an emotional level, whether or not it was consummated sexually or not. Only history will tell, and they destroyed all the correspondence that might have told us.
Now, here's a question for you, Max. I feel extremely curious to know whether they were having an affair or not, whether they were sleeping with each other or not. But you would probably say that that's none of my business, would you?
Well, I would say that it's none of your or my business, but I share your curiosity, but I completely assume they did. Mm. And they went off to Paris, I think, for 6 weeks together.
It is,
and
right.
I cannot believe that that wasn't a bit of consummation.
I find it quite, when you read their letters to each other, it is quite hard to imagine that they didn't.
As P.J. O'Rourke puts it, it's always tempting to impute unlikely virtues to the cute. Do you think that Mill was imputing unlikely intelligence to Harriet Richard, or was he right about her brilliance?
He was overstating the case. And I actually think that's had a slightly unfortunate side effect, because Mill so overstated Harriet's kind of brilliance. I mean, you know, in all domains, he put her on a pedestal, and then of course he created this kind of Carrara marble tomb for her as well when she died. So, because he did that, actually, it meant that he kind of gave room, I think, to Harriet's critics to just say, look, he'd just been completely blinded by love, and as a result of that, he attributed these values to her, and it seems to me that that's an entirely forgivable sin.
Harriet's husband died of cancer in 1849, quite unexpectedly, so they were able to marry. But Mill drew up a disclaimer.
I, having no means of legally divesting myself of these odious powers, feel it my duty to put on record a formal protest against the existing law of marriage, in so far as conferring such powers, and a solemn promise never, in any case, or under any circumstances, to use them.
Richard, that's not a very romantic declaration, is it?
No. The difficulty was, of course, that they both disapproved of marriage as an institution, as it was then formulated legally, with effectively women having no legal rights. But what it did was it sort of said, look, we are doing this despite our protest about the kind of, you know, the nature of marriage as it is as a kind of current institution.
It was sort of outrageous. And I think it was the Married Women's Property Act 1882 or something like that.
Correct.
It was the first time there was any recognition of women's rights in that. But, of course, there again, if you had the right relationship, it wouldn't actually matter, because the wife would be able to trust the husband. But nevertheless, the laws are outrageous. And considering that Mill was somebody who would fit in completely with modern sort of intellectual liberal circles, it must have been immensely offensive to him.
I think it was hugely painful. I mean, of course, they did choose to marry. I mean, they could have been more radical and chosen not to marry. I guess that was a bridge too far for them at that stage. But, I mean, you're right. I mean, Mill's radicalism extended to him publicly campaigning against men having the right to force their wives to have sex with them. And in fact, the UK only made marital rape illegal in the last, I mean, I think it was in the 1990s. And Mill was arguing publicly for that in the 1850s. And so actually his radical view about marriage, and one which he and Harriet actually did demonstrate, was it should be of equals, intellectual and economic and sexual equals. It should be a genuine partnership between husband and wife. And they did have this kind of very idealised view about what marriage could and should be, which feels both very utopian, very modern and very inspiring.
UMax would approve of the fact that not so long after that, instead of just writing and talking about what people ought to do, he became a Member of Parliament.
He did, and a sort of interesting Member of Parliament, because one of the few things that I noticed about him was that he was in favour of capital punishment for the, to me, rather strange reason that it's unpleasant to lock somebody up in the sort of prisons they had in those days for life. But I would have thought that it's perfectly all right to say to the person you've got a choice. You can be hung if you feel like it, but otherwise you can live in this rather unpleasant prison. But he was actually in favour, which to me is very out of touch with the rest of his views.
He was no great orator, was he?
No, he was terrible when he started in Parliament. I mean, just awful. And actually, I think it was Disraeli that kind of described him as, said, oh, here comes the governess, because he was hectoring and lecturing. He always had his hands behind his back, and so he had to learn. But what's good about Mill, actually, was that he recognised he was failing to capture the House, and he learned. He got better, he got funnier, he got more combative, and his skills as an orator, whilst they were never great, and they became a lot better and became much, much more effective. But it's clear that that wasn't his comfort zone. He was more comfortable in a study writing an essay or playing the piano for Harriet than he was standing on his feet in the Commons. But nonetheless, you know, that's what his causes demanded, so that's what he did.
You're a good speaker. Max. I've attended various debates, usually on the other side of the argument from you. And but, you know, because you've been involved in motor racing and things like that, I hadn't expected you to be such a relaxed and commanding speaker. Has that come late to you, or did you always know you could do it?
No, that, it's very kind of you to say that. Well, I've always found it very difficult to speak in public. I'm basically very shy, and it requires a huge effort. But I found out at Oxford and then later that it's quite important to be able to do it. And then I learnt during the sort of motor racing phase that you could become enormously popular if you kept your speeches very short, because most people don't do that. So that was really my technique, shortened to the point.
You give the impression in debate that you really don't care what people think, and it's terrifically refreshing for your audience. Are you aware that this is unusual?
Well, it's certainly true that, I mean, I'm quite happy to stand in front of people, every single one of which disagrees with me, but it's very pleasant when that doesn't happen. But I think it's absolutely essential to be prepared to put one's case, no matter how difficult that might be.
Do you worry now that all the work that you've done in motor racing, in road safety and all those things, it's a pretty solid career. Do you worry that that's just going to be totally overshadowed and people will forget the work that you've done?
To some extent, but I think because of what's happened since the News of the World case and my involvement with Leveson and all the business to do with privacy and Murdoch and phone hacking and so on, where I've been very busy, people at least see that, well, I didn't run away and hide at the end of it. And that's really all you can do. I mean, once you're dead, it doesn't really matter to you what people think. It only matters to your family. So, I mean, I'll just continue doing the best I can. And even though I'm getting on a bit now, maybe the opportunity will come to do something significant still. And if it does come, I shall. But in the end, you just have to accept your fate.
Like his beloved Harriet, Mill also died in France, in Avignon, in 1873, with a chorus of nightingales in his ears. Richard, what's turned out to be the most remarkable thing that Mill did? His actions, his campaigns, or his writing?
Well, I think in the end you have to be fair and say that if he hadn't written on liberty in particular, that perhaps we wouldn't be having this conversation now. And so whilst I strongly argue that his life, and in particular, you know, his description by Fawcett as the principal originator of the women's suffrage movement was hugely important, and his campaigns were genuinely inspiring, I also think we have to actually say that those kind of intellectual pieces of work that he did on liberty and the subjection of women remain a hugely important part of the kind of canon of any sort of liberal sort of civilized society. My view actually is, though, that he probably wouldn't have ended up writing those great works if he hadn't been so engaged and passionate in his own life. And so in the end, the kind of greatness of his life is what I think led to the kind of greatness of his work. And when you see the two together, you can see that he wasn't only a kind of great liberal thinker, but he was a kind of liberal activist and someone willing to risk actually a good deal for his beliefs. And that remains inspiring, I think, to many people today.
Would John Stuart Mill have recommended you to sue the News of the World?
I think absolutely. I think he would have said, if you never do anything in your life again, you must sue those people and you must hold them to account.
Thank you to my guests, Max Mosley and Richard Reeves, and to reader Patrick Brennan for this programme on the life of John Stuart Mill. Thank you too for listening. And until next time, goodbye. Thank you for downloading this programme from Radio 4. There are some 250 other editions of Great Lives available on the Radio 4 website.